Welcome back to the Voice of Bombay, 102 FM, and it's Marina Sexton here, and I'm right here now with His Honor John Crosby, the Lieutenant Governor of Newfoundland and Labrador, and I'd like to welcome you to our radio station and the Julianne Walsh Heritage Center.
Yes, well, it's wonderful to be here, Marina. We're having a terrific time at your celebration here, and Norris the Point, and your community here is to be congratulated on how well they've conducted affairs and all the initiatives you've taken, and we're enjoying this whole festival tremendously. It's been a great success, and we're sorry we didn't get here sooner, and we can't stay longer, but it's been a wonderful experience.
Well, we'll invite you back next year.
Good.
A few weeks ago at Government House, you presented Joni Cranston the Manning Award for the Bombay Heritage Committee.
Right.
And I'd like you to comment on that. What do you think of our building that we have here and what we've done?
Well, I think it's very impressive that the community here and interested people took the initiative to make sure that the former hospital just, you know, wasn't wasted, and to make something out of the community assets such as you've done. It just shows the kind of initiatives that the people of your community are capable of taking, and you're very much to be congratulated. And this is a wonderful asset. You got your radio and the library and all these other facilities still operating from the old hospital. I think it's one of the wisest of the heritage awards. So we were very impressed when we heard about it. And so when we decided we should come out here to your festival, that was the reason, really, that we thought about your community again. I think Jane and I were here 7 years ago. It was the last time we were in this area, and now you've got this outstanding marine facility, the memorials facility here, and all of these other local initiatives. The whole place is beautiful. Everybody is very entrepreneurial. It's a marvelous thing to see, so we're really enjoying ourselves.
We're glad. You've seen the greenhouse we're doing out back, and we're also working on putting together community gardens.
Right.
And in speaking to your wife, Jane, yesterday, she mentioned at Government House that you're taking on a community garden initiative.
Jane has taken it on, because I've given her many warnings that she better not expect that I'm going to be down working in the garden, right? I used to cut the lawn and so on, but now I've even don't have to do that anymore. But yes, she's got a project down there, and the students in who are part of the Duke of Edinburgh program, and they're in, and well, Government House has got about 20 acres of land there, right in the center of St. John's, and the government has wisely preserved it, and so we've got lots of area down there, and she's got these students, younger people, and they're putting in a vegetable garden this year, so she's busy with that. And we're lucky to have some fine young people who are in the Duke of Edinburgh program, and they're working on it now and planting it, so it's great. And it's even greater that I don't have to do anything.
I was going to ask, when you become Lieutenant Governor, you have to move into Government House. How big a change is that, leaving your own home and having to move into another?
Well, it's quite a change, but the Newfoundland government, give them credit, the successive governments have kept the place up. It's quite a large building, it's watertight and warm enough. It's got the heated and light. You know, all of that kind of thing is there. So we like it, and we live on the second floor, and we have a small kitchen and a sitting room that we can use on the second floor, and we're usually there on the weekends without the staff go on Friday evening, and they don't come back until Monday morning, and so we we have to look after ourselves on the weekends, and it's quite comfortable. And we still have our own home, which is out in Mount Pearl. Out in Portugal Coast and Phillips and Hogan's Pan. And it's only a 20-minute drive, you know, so that if we want to go out for the weekend or last fall, we spent about 6 weeks out there because they were finally putting an elevator in the government house, and because government house has a basement and the kitchen is in the basement, then there's the first floor and the second floor, and you need an elevator to bring food up and down, and not only that, but I mean a government facility should have wheelchair accessibility, etc. So the government finally did, with some persuasion, spend some money on putting an elevator in this fall, and we couldn't use the kitchen, so we moved back out, and there's no problem doing that because we're only a 20-minute drive away, you know. So that's all working out pretty well.
Now, when I think of home, even though I was born in St. John's, when I think of home, I think now of Norris Point as my home. When you think of the place that you consider home, the place that you're most relaxed, would it be your house in Portugal Cove, or is there somewhere else that holds a very special place in your heart?
No, I think it's our place at Hogan's Pond, because we're so lucky. It's a good size of a pond, and it's not far from the city. But you're out in the country, and I got about 17 acres of land out there, and you know, which is trees, and the Avalon Peninsula, as you know, is not very fertile area. The glacier swept all the soil and everything else off in the Grand Banks, which made the Grand Banks fine for fish. But the Avalon Peninsula is pretty puny when it comes to growing anything or trees. You know, it's not till you get out to central Newfoundland, the west coast, you even see some decent-sized trees. We've been in there now about, 30 years. And, now it's luckily when we got land out there, it was a very, very, you know, reasonable price. Land today is amazing. Mm-hmm. Out in Hogan's Pond, it's a 2-acre lot. You have to have 2 acres to build on the shore of the pond. And a 2-acre lot out there now, the going price appears to be around $200,000 an acre, or a lot, not an acre. It's astounding how the cost of everything, land and housing, has gone up. And so we're delighted to be out there. And, you know, you're in the country, in the Newfoundland outport environment, but you're only 20 minutes from urban St. John's. So we're very lucky that this happened. You know, I acquired the land some years ago.
Now, you've had a long, colorful political career, and verbal repartee, shall we say, was the weapon of choice. And even though I may not have always agreed with your politics, I was always proud of the way that you stood up for Newfoundland and Labrador and Ottawa. I mean, you're known for your incisive wit. Dealing with the people you did on the Hill, who would you say had the best sense of humor, and who had the worst sense of humor in your career?
Well, the best sense of humor was that I had a lot of fun with George Baker, who was then the MP from the Gander area, Gander Twillingate, and he's now, George has gone to the Senate heaven. He's now a senator. But George and I used to have a lot of, he's got a good sense of humor, etc., fun back and forth in the question period. And the question period I enjoyed. I seemed to suit it, and I was able to do well in the question period. And Mr. Trudeau was the prime minister for a lot of the time I was there, and he was a great one to ask a question of. You knew if you asked Mr. Trudeau a question, he was intelligent and alert, etc., that you had to be ready for whatever his response would be, because he usually had a very good response and good counterattack in any questioner, and you had to be ready to respond to him. And I remember one time I had asked him a question, and he answered me in Latin. And now I'm not a linguist, you know, but it just so happened I'm a lawyer, and so I remember the phrase that lawyers use often, res ipsa loquitur, the thing speaks for itself. So when I asked Trudeau, when I replied to his reply, I said, I answered him, res ipsa loquitur, and the thing speaks for itself, whatever. It fitted the answer anyway. So Trudeau came back then to me with a question in Greek. I was damn lucky that I had gone to a boarding school, and the boarding school had a Greek motto. The St. Andrew's College just was up in Ontario, and so I was able to answer in the Greek motto that we had, which I, at the moment, slips my memory. But anyway, it was appropriate. Oh, yeah, could you like men be strong? That's the translation of the motto. So when I answered Trudeau, that's what I gave him, the Greek for the thing, that was suited him. And so we had this exchange in Latin and Greek, and the Globe and Mail, featured it and played it up, so it looked as though I was an expert in Latin and Greek, and Trudeau was an expert in Latin and Greek. But so you had to be lucky in these things sometimes. But he was always you had to be on your toes if you were going to ask him a question, because he was quick-witted, and so you had to be ready, to deal with him. So the question period, it was often fun, and if you were good at that, that was good publicity for you. You got coverage. But that was the one I remember best. Trudeau thought he had me by the short and curly when he answered in Latin and Greek, but I happened to have these two little bits in Latin and Greek, so I sounded like I was a genius too. So there were some amusing moments like that. I enjoyed politics, and I didn't particularly want to retire back in 1993, but Jane had been very good, my wife, and I'd been 10 years in Newfoundland politics and then 17 years in Ottawa, and I liked it. I liked politics. My toughest years were the years that I was Minister of Fisheries, when we had the collapse of the cod fishery, finally completely collapsed. These were tough years. But that's what you're elected for, you're elected to try to represent the people and help them, and I survived. But my toughest years in politics were those last couple of years when I was Minister of Fisheries, because the collapse of the cod fishery was so significant for Newfoundland, and again persuading my colleagues who were trying to get the spending under control, and there had been a lot of debt incurred, and it wasn't easy to get. I mean, I knew we were going to have to shut the fishery down because the quota that the scientists would approve for that year, it was 50,000. I think they concluded. The federal Canadian experts met with the NATO experts, and they all agreed that 50,000 tons of cod was the maximum that could be allowed to be taken off of the Newfoundland area that year. That meant it was impossible to have a fishery, because, as you know, the fish come in first, the cod come in first down south, and then they come up the northeast coast, and then they finally reach White Bay and then Labrador, and the whole quota would have been used up before we got to White Bay or Labrador. And those fishermen wouldn't have been able to fish at all. So that wasn't politically possible. I knew that we were going to have to shut the fishery until somehow give the fishery a time to hopefully come back by closing the season altogether. And that was very difficult period. But I survived it, and all you can do is try to convince the people that you're doing your best for them, and that you're that you've done everything you can. And but this has to happen, and now all these years later, the cod fishery is still not back. And I think personally myself that the wild fish fishery of the world, we're unlikely to have a viable wild fish fishery in the world anywhere by the end of this century. We have to change the common property ownership of fish to have a proper system. Everyone, professional fishermen, should have his own quota, and something that encourages them all to practice conservation. If we don't do that, then I think that the pressure on the on fish is just going to be too great. I'm not optimistic about the state of fisheries throughout the world. I mean, it's an amazing thing. I can't remember the exact statistics, but let's say that there's 250 million or 300 million tons of fish caught in the world in a year. The astounding fact is that one-third of that amount is discarded, caught and wasted. It's the fish that are caught that are of no value to the fishermen, so they throw it back, or reasons like that, and tremendous wastage and spoilage all over the world. I'm not just talking about off Canada now, or West Coast or East Coast, but everywhere in the world. And so the problem is that there's just too great a catch of fish for the resource to be able to withstand the pressure. And I don't see anything that's happened in the last 10 or 15 years to improve that. And in fact, in Canada, you know, the federal government is spending less money on scientific research than it used to. So I can't be optimistic about what's going to happen to the fishery.
Yes, living in an area where we're so dependent on the fish, I find that sad, but I totally agree with what you're saying there.
Well, I think rural Newfoundland, it's the tourism and the cultural renaissance and the music renaissance and the writing, literary renaissance in Newfoundland. That's the main asset now of rural Newfoundland. You take this area here, Norris Point and Bombay. You have a magnificent tourism in this area because of its beauty, and you've done your best to use all the assets that are here. It's shown great initiative, and rural Newfoundland, that's the direction it has to take. And you're leading the way. I mean, I'm very positive about the Bombay area and how well you, Woody Point and your community, and how advantage has been taken by you of all of these natural advantages you have and the initiatives that have been shown. It's very, very impressive, and we wouldn't have missed. We're delighted that we've had two or three days here, because the whole thing has been tremendously pleasurable. I'm not much of a singer myself, or a musician. I made the mistake. I took music lessons for a year when I was a boy, and at that time I was more interested in cowboys and Indians and learning the piano, which I regret. But all the talent that you've had here in the last couple of days, it's amazing the talent we have in Newfoundland, and it's really a big asset for us. And I've seen people here in the last couple of days from Alberta, all around, Newfoundlanders coming back. So I think for Newfoundland and the rural area in particular, we've got to build on the tourism, and perhaps hopefully if the fishery will come back and do better than it's done. But it's not going to be like it was before, you know, like the 19th century or the early up to World War II. I mean, after World War II, the world changed, and and the long-distance fisheries became possible in factory freezer trawlers. I remember my father was one of the first ones to go over to England, and he went out on one of the first British long-distance trawlers back in the 19, just after the war, say 46, 47, and to see how they worked, and because that was going to be the future, and that has been the future. But the fishing pressure, the result is, of course, that the fish stocks are in trouble because we overfish them. And if we can't, imagine now that a third of all the world's fish caught every year is wasted and thrown away. It's particularly bad in the Pacific, where they use these huge drift nets, and the drift nets catch every kinds of species, and a lot of which the fish catchers don't want and can't use, and they throw it out. A third of the world's fishery caught every year is wasted. This is shows you that we're not going to change. The world's fishery is headed for a very difficult period if we can't change that, you know.
There was a Cura workshop here, and there's a number of people who were interested in marrying the fishery and tourism. If the fishermen could have a quota that they catch and sell locally, and then we could advertise, we have the freshest fish going. We could have it in our restaurants instead of scrounging, trying to get fresh fish to serve.
Yeah.
What do you think of that idea, if there was some way of making that work?
Well, I think that would be very helpful. I think that... Well, the lobsters, of course, are always valuable, and crab. We're very lucky that the crab fishery expanded so greatly, and the other shellfish fisheries. When the cod went, because the cod was a great predator of those species, as you know, and now a lot of fishermen have been able to make a living off of crab and shrimp and always, of course, off lobster. So we've got to be very careful with those species and concentrate on them. And the more you can use them in the tourist trade, I mean, people come to Newfoundland, they're expecting and hoping to get good to fish, you know. And so that's what we've got to produce for them. So I don't think the Royal Newfoundland is finished. I think that another thing is that we think our weather is not that great, and I have to admit that I'm 79 and I can't remember a spring that was ever decent, right? I never experienced a good spring in Newfoundland in 79 years, poor John, and that's still the case. We don't have a good spring, but we have a summer that's not too hot, and we've got to use that to attract people. I remember having to spend some summers up in Ottawa, and at the end of March is great in Ottawa because spring is very pleasant up there, and it starts immediately. But the summer, God, the heat, the humidity, and all over North America, that's the same. So we have to attract people on the basis that they can get out of the sweltering heat of the cities there and come down to Newfoundland, and you're not going to swelter at 85 or 90 degrees or high humidity. That's one of the virtues we have, I think, for summer tourism, that we have decent, the temperatures are not too high, you know, the humidity is not too great. And when you drive around Newfoundland, you go around Newfoundland, all of our best terrain and most beautiful locations are all along the coast. And luckily, land is still relatively reasonable in price in these areas. So we've got to use that as one of our advantages. And I don't think myself personally that rural Newfoundland is finished. It's just that its potential now is in other areas, and such as you're one of the prime examples of an area that's doing well. And basically, it's because you attract people to it. You attract a lot of people from within Newfoundland and from outside. And they get down here and they come back again. So that's the direction I think we have to go in rural Newfoundland. And we're very lucky with oil and gas so far. That's not going to last forever, as you know. in the next 10 years, our revenue, the government's revenues and oil and gas are going to go up, and then they're going to start down again very rapidly, and we've only got about 10 years left of the good oil and gas supply offshore, unless we can get develop resources outside the John Dark Basin where all our present producing fields are. And it's usually expensive now to explore, a couple of $100 million that you've got to gamble as an investment when you go outside the Jeanne d'Arc Basin into deeper water, such as is going on now in the Orphan Basin and out in the Flemish Cap. So we've got to hope that we're going to discover other oil and gas discoveries outside the Jeanne d'Arc Basin if this is to continue. And hopefully it will.
Now, over the years, who would you say was probably your toughest political adversary?
Well, Mr. Smallwood was my toughest political adversary. When I fell out with him, I had been in his cabinet for 2 years. I had been Minister of Municipal Affairs, and then he made me Minister of Health to prepare for Medicare. But the problem with Mr. Smallwood was that he had been, so dominant for so long, by that time, 20 years in power, that when I joined the cabinet first, Mr. Smallwood would come in to open the cabinet meeting, and he'd talk for an hour and a half or so, and whatever he wanted to talk about, and everybody else would sit around like a dummy, listening in rapt attention to Mr. Smallwood. And if you asked a question, Clyde Wells, for example, and I used to ask questions, everybody was surprised if anybody asked Joe a question, and he didn't like it. He was, by that time, you see, he was paranoid. I mean, if you've got absolute power for 20 years, you become paranoid. So if I asked a question or Clyde, he got suspicious of us that we were trying to supplant him. He was quite paranoid. So it only took me a week or two in his cabinet meetings that Mr. Smallwood, I knew I couldn't take this. I wasn't the type that was going to sit around and listen like a dummy to Mr. Smallwood or anyone else go on for an hour and a half or 2 hours and decide everything, and you were discouraged from asking questions or even casting, even starting to disagree on policy or whatever. So that I'd say Mr. Smallwood was my most redoubtable at that time opponent, but in a way it was good training. I don't regret any of it. The experience was invaluable later. You learn how to take it and to fight back, and I don't knock Mr. Smallwood now. Mr. Smallwood is no longer in power, and he was a great Newfoundlander and believed in a lot of what he was doing, but that he was probably my greatest opponent. Mr. Trudeau, of course, was a redoubtable person as well, very able and very certain of himself, and I had admired him as well. I voted for Mr. Trudeau. I was a Liberal when he got I went to the Liberal convention that elected Mr. Trudeau as leader, and I couldn't forgive myself later on. I voted for Trudeau, of course nobody would believe me, but he was a great opponent. You have to I've never been sore at opponents. That's the nature of politics. Everybody can't agree, and they're doing their best, and they have to put forward their points of view. So I never personally, very few people in politics, no matter what party they were in, that I disliked. I liked politicians because they have a tough life, and it's a very uncertain one. And I always have liked the political animals, so I never felt sore. There's a few now. I won't name any names, but there's some that I didn't like, but I liked politicians as a species. Of course, I was one myself, so why would I knock politicians, you know? They got their good points and their bad points. I'm a little disappointed in recent years. I like leaders that are going to lead. What's the point of being the leader of a political party if you can't persuade the public that something you want done is the right thing to do? I mean, that's what being a leader means. So I'm disappointed that in recent years, a lot of the prominent politicians are very careful, eh? They want to be very careful not to say anything that's controversial. Well, I'm now Lieutenant Governor, so I have to be impartial and watch what I say publicly. So far I've been pretty careful, and I have to act impartially. But how can you make a speech if you don't annoy anyone? The Lieutenant Governor is supposed not to say anything that might even annoy a large body of people. Well, my position is I never made a speech when I was a politician that didn't annoy some people, right? What's the good of the speech? Can't be much of a speech if it doesn't annoy or cause somebody to disagree with you. But so as Lieutenant Governor, it's a little, I find it a bit difficult, but I'm so far I've been successful not to be, I'm not partisan. I mean, I hope I treat everybody equally as Lieutenant Governor, but it's hard to make an interesting speech if you can't be controversial or you can't annoy anyone. So I think I'm going to speak for a few minutes here tonight, and I hope I can amuse people. I mean, they want to be amused. They don't want to just hear some rhetoric, you know, it's not meaning, you know, it's not really interesting. You can't make an interesting speech if you can't be controversial. That's my experience. So I'll see how I do tonight. I'm certainly not going to be attacking anyone here, of course. I want to get out alive tomorrow.
Now, over your career, I'm sure you've been witness to some history-making moments. Is there any moment that stands out in your mind that you were thinking to yourself, wow, I'm here while this piece of history is being made?
Well, I think that the fishery crisis of 1990, that, you know, 1989-1991 was the biggest crisis I experienced and the most traumatic because, you know, I had to face... I remember going down to Trepassey, which is part of my district, and Trepassey had a big fish plant, and the plant had to be closed when we reduced the quotas had to be so reduced that the plant at Trepassey had to close. So I did everything I could to see that it stayed open, but I wasn't able to. And then I had to go down to Trepassey and meet them down there, 1,000 people in a hall in Trepassey, who 500 of whom had learned that their jobs were gone, and they're in an area where if you're not without the fish plant, there wasn't other economic business that you could carry on with. So the 500 of them and their wives and so on, were, I had to face them and explain what I had been trying to do, etc. And one of the amusing things was that Richard Cashin told me that the union had sent down photographers and so on. They figured I was going to be slaughtered down in Trepassey by these people, naturally. And so they wanted to get some pictures of all of this, you know, to use to attack the government or whatever. And anyway, I tried to do my best to explain to these 1,000 people who are all very upset, as you would be when you had just learned that your career was ruined and you're going to lose your job, etc. And there were many women working in the fish plant, and it's a main form of economic activity. But in any event, I spoke for an hour or so, and the crowd asked questions, and they didn't run me out of town, right? They didn't attack me. I survived. And because they, I think they felt, well, that I had done all I could do for them, and I was going to continue to do that. And at the end of this meeting, they gave me a standing ovation. Now, that was my high point in my political career, that the people in my own district, in desperate straits as they had found that they were now in, had listened to me and give me a standing ovation when I finished with them. So that was probably my high point in politics, which I'll never forget.
I've often thought that must have been incredibly difficult for you, being a Newfoundlander and being the Minister of Fisheries and having to be the messenger
right.
on this terrible time in history.
Yeah. Well, there was a cabinet shuffle. Mr. Mulroney shuffled his cabinet. I'd been Minister of International Trade, U.S.-Canada trade deal and so on. And it was a great post, you know, a lot of travel and meeting lots of interesting people and so on. And he had a cabinet shuffle, and so he wanted to make Michael Wilson, who had been Minister of Finance for donkey's years, the Minister of International Trade, and he offered me I could go in other portfolios, one of which was dealing with unemployment insurance at the Employment Department, and I said no. I don't want to do that. I'm going to continue on. I want to be Minister of Fisheries, because you can't live in Newfoundland if you're the federal minister for the province. You're held responsible for everything that goes on in the fishery, even though you're not the Minister of Fisheries. So, and I said, no, I'd prefer to be Minister of Fisheries, because at least as the minister, then I can decide what's going to happen in the fisheries area pretty well. So I said, I'll prefer you make me Minister of Fisheries and Oceans, but I want to be the minister in charge of ACOA, the Atlantic Canada Opportunities Agency, as well, because I said, I've got to have some money. You know, if you're Minister of Fisheries, you're not going to be too popular. You've got to have something, you know, that gives you a chance to spend a bit of money and help the province that way. So he agreed, and I was the Minister of Fisheries and Oceans and the Minister in charge of ACOA, which was a great portfolio, and they had, it was one of the few areas where money was, you know, was being spent. So that helped me survive as Minister of Fisheries and Oceans, because I was also Minister of ACOA. And but that was the most difficult time I had in politics. I mean, you can understand. I remember another occasion that the National Sea had to close their plant in St. John's. That was in my district as well. And I had 800 or so come over on a protest thing, you know, Confederation building. And I had to face those poor people who were in desperate straits as well. And that was another ticklish situation. But anyway, I think they all felt, you know, that I was doing my best, and so I survived it. But my two most traumatic years in politics were those 2 years, you know.
What would you say would be your proudest moment as a Newfoundlander?
Well, I'm very proud of how well we're doing now. You know, the present government, I think, has got a positive record, and we're lucky that we've. Well, the biggest accomplishment I had, I think, in my political life was that I persuaded Mr. Mulroney and the government to save the Hibernia project. And to do that, the federal government had to guarantee a lot of money in advance loans and go all out to save the Hibernia project. And this was at a time when the federal government was not in good financial shape, etc. But luckily for me, Mr. Mulroney was very supportive of Newfoundland and of me. And so he came through when the federal government saved the Hibernia project. They had to put up $2 or $3 billion in loans and guarantees, etc., and the thing turned out to be a tremendous success. But the federal government saved the Hibernia project. Remember, Chevron withdrew and mm-hmm. had to be replaced. And as a result, then we had the Discovery Well just a few months later, the next year. And the whole thing has gone on from there, and our offshore has been a great success for us financially and a great help to the Newfoundland government. So that was probably the most significant thing, influence that I had, you know, that was positive for Newfoundland. I was very lucky that I had the Prime Minister who was supportive, you know, because without the Prime Minister's backing, there's not a hell of a lot Cabinet Ministers can do in Ottawa or anywhere else. So he was a tower of strength, and I've always supported him since. And he knew something about Newfoundland because he had been president of the Iron Ore Company of Canada, you know. So I'm very fond and supportive still of Mr. Mulroney.
Now, I heard a funny story years ago when you and your wife Jane and Sheila Guy Murphy and John Murphy were, I believe, in Paris, and there was a pickpocket.
Yes.
Would you like to tell the story? Because Sheila Guy Murphy is a real character. I mean, a character that I really enjoy.
Yes, she is indeed. Well, we were in Paris, and we were on the left bank, and we were walking. We were walking up the boulevard, one of the main streets on the left bank there in Paris, and I had a wallet in my back pocket. And Jane and I were walking ahead of Sheila and John Murphy, and I suddenly heard Sheila yell out in horrendous tones and tripped this fellow up who was behind me, and he was just had my wallet out of my back pocket when Sheila jumped him and knocked him to the ground. Sure enough, I put my hand there. The wallet, it was half out of my arse pocket, as they call it. And she gave him a hell of a start. And he jumped up, and the next thing I saw him running about 100 miles an hour down the road and trying to get away from Sheila. So Sheila had saved my wallet and whatever money I had in it and so on. So she's a great character and big community spirit, and she's a great Newfoundlander as well, and as you know, she's involved in all of these theatrical mm-hmm. performances, and she's great fun. And John was the mayor of St. John's, and he's always been good value as well, so I'm very fond of Sheila and John.
Now, a lot of politicians in this day and age, you know, because the media is so much in people's lives, you know, we hear about all these politicians having affairs and cheating on their wives and their political career falling apart. But you seem to have taken a page out of Paul Newman's book, where Why Go Out for Hamburger When You Have Steak at Home? You seem to not just love your wife, but really respect your wife. How did you meet Jane?
Well, I met her in kindergarten. I'm an old Spencerian, right? I went to Bishop Spencer for kindergarten and grade one. In those days, that's where you went to, and then you went back to Bishop Field College in grade two. So I was in Spencer, and apparently I was quite the bully boy when I was younger, and I was a terror of the kindergarten, and there was a cloakroom where everybody had to hang their coats, and I was accused of kidnapping the girls and pushing them around and getting them in this place where the coats were and imprisoning them there. And they were all in awe and terror of me, you know. I can't remember being such a desperado, but anyway, this is my story. So that's where I met Jane. She was in Bishop Spencer as well in kindergarten with me. So then the years passed, and I met her at a dance when she was 17, And it was a program dance. You know, in those days, you'd have a party, and you'd have a dance, and you'd give everyone the program, and so you'd get the girls to agree to dance number five.
Dance
card. A dance card. So I was struck by Jane, a lovely-looking girl. So I got her card and filled in every dance. And then I got a friend. I had my license, driving license in, but I got a friend to drive the car. I said to Jane, I'll give you a run home, you know. But I got a friend to drive the car so I could play the Lothario with her in the back seat on the way home. And we went a long way home. We dropped some of the other people off. And when we got to her father's home, it was 2:30 in the morning. And much to my horror, when we got to the front door, the door opened. Here was Dr. Furneaux. And he was looking very displeased, right, that his daughter had been kept out till 2:30 in the morning. But anyway, he eventually forgave me. And so that's when I started courting Jane. And then I had a crisis with her when I got elected the first time in the by-election, October the 18th, which was Trudeau's birthday, by the way. He delayed the by-election in St. John's East, St. John's West. Walter Carter had resigned to run in the provincial election, and the by-election wasn't held until a year later, and Trudeau's birthday, and I got elected in this by-election. And then Jane, we had a dog, a beautiful dog, a Dandy Dinman, but Jane was in love with, and all the family, and he was now 14 or 15. So Jane said she couldn't come to Ottawa with me. She had to stay back to look after the dog. So I went on up in the end of October and spent a couple of months there. And when I came back Christmas time, I said, now look here, Jane, it's either the dog or me, right? You got to make your mind up. Well, I was taking big risks there, you know. There was by no means certain that she's going to choose me. But anyway, luckily for me, she did. And she came to Ottawa, and she was. It's essential, I think, if you're elected as a federal MP, that if you're a woman, your husband's there with you, or vice versa, because there's nothing but marital difficulties arise out of being separated, because you've got to, and weekends, even, you can't go back to your district every weekend. If you're doing well, you're asked to speak somewhere for the party or do this or that or the other. So it's very difficult if you don't see your wife for a month, you know, for a month or two. And my experience is that where husbands and wives don't move together to Ottawa, it often results in marriage breakdown. But anyway, she, luckily for me, Jane decided to come to Ottawa, and she was a tower of strength there. And she became president of the PC Women and then president of the Parliamentary Women's Association, and did well. And then when I got to be a minister at election time and couldn't spend much time in my own district, she'd go door to door. She's a terrific campaigner. So she's responsible, if I've been successful, for a lot of it. And now we're married 56 years, and I'm still mad about her. I don't know what... she's mad with me. I'm mad about her, but she's usually mad about me, or mad with me. So she's been a great partner. Eh? It's so essential that the husband and wives, that you have a good mate.
Mm-hmm.
So she's been wonderful, and I'm very lucky.
When Prince Charles and Camilla were in Newfoundland a while back, I was told that you and Charles really hit it off. And I'm not sure if I got this correct, but is he pro seal hunt?
He's as a matter of fact, Charles is publicly supported the elimination of the red squirrels, I think it is. There's two types of squirrels in the UK. There's a native squirrel. I'm not sure if that's the red one or the black one. But the native squirrel has been driven out by the red squirrel, if I have it right. One of those types of squirrels is native to the UK. The other one got brought in somehow. and is very aggressive and is driving the other the native squirrel out. And Charles is in charge of a campaign to do away with, I think it's the red squirrels have to be done away with. And so he's not your typical English person as far as animals are concerned, because the English are, you know, they're a bit batty about animals. And so I knew that Charles probably wouldn't be against a seal hunt, but whether he was or wasn't, Elaine Dobbin had a seal coat of her husband Craig had, beautiful seal coat, and one made from so-called baby seals, you know, lovely grey white coat, and she loaned me the coat and said I should wear it while Charles was around. So we had Charles and Camilla had to plant a tree, and I wore, when we went out to plant the tree, I slipped on Craig's seal coat and went out. And this caused, you know, the photographers took pictures, etc., because, as you know, the seal hunt is controversial. But I'm for the seal hunt. We have caught seals in Newfoundland for 3,000 years, the Aborigines long before we came here. And we would have starved to death if we hadn't killed seals and killed rabbits and killed caribou and so on, the same as the Aboriginals had to do. And my family had been in the sealing business. In fact, my father sent a vessel out to the seal fishery in 1934 with Captain Peter Carter and Olaf Olsen, and he were partners, and brought back 49,600 seals, the biggest catch of seals in the history of the seal fishery. So I'm not going to apologize to anyone about the seal fishery, or that there's anything wrong or is any crueler than the killing beaver or whatever other animals. I mean, people had to, the Aboriginals had to kill fish and kill seals and caribou, the same as we had to when Europeans arrived here. So I'm a defender of the seal hunt, and I'm not going to apologize for it. And of course, I don't want to see unnecessary cruelty or whatever. So I wore the seal jacket, and Camilla came out and noticed me in this coat, which is very noticeable. And she looked at Jane in a quizzical way. And Jane said, she said, you know, he's making a statement. So she understood that. Camilla understood, and so did Charles, that I was making a statement. So they didn't complain about it, you know. But Charles is not your typical English person who's so crazy about, you know, animals as they are in England.
Yeah, a lot of these seal-hugging pro-animal people are urbanites who have no idea how the meat gets on their table.
My God, listen. Look, they think that when you go in the supermarket, that somebody manufactured a roast of beef. You know, they don't say that somebody had to kill a cow for you to have a roast of beef that you can buy in the supermarket. I mean, people's memories are so short. Well, look, I'm getting letters, hundreds of letters from Germany about the seal hunt. Well, they're all form letters. You can see everyone is the same. Now, I don't bother to answer them. It takes too much time. I take them and throw them in the wastebasket. I have them counted and so on to see how many foolish nuts from Germany have written me letters about the seal hunt. But there's organized campaigns because the people don't understand. It's astounding. If you don't understand your history, I'm very keen on everyone knowing their history. And there's a... So I try to promote this book that was published there about 6 months ago by the Newfoundland History Society, and The Short History of Newfoundland is called. And it's an excellent job. Five professors at Memorial wrote the various sections of it. And if you want to know Newfoundland history, it'll only take you an evening to read this book. It's only about 140 pages. And I believe that every Newfoundlander should read the history and understand the history of Newfoundland, so they can understand where. How can you understand how we are as we are now if you don't understand what your history is? And so I'm very keen on history, and that's an excellent book, and I try to promote it. And another great book that I try to promote is a book that Bill Ramke did as editor on the city of St. John's during World War II. Bill is very interested in writing, and as you know, he's a senator now. He used to be your MP up here, I think, in the White Bay, Labrador. And he's edited this book, and it's a marvelous account of how important the city of St. John's was in the Battle of the North Atlantic. And so I bought a lot of Bill's books, which I give to visitors to Newfoundland, so they'll understand that we were an important part of the Battle of the North Atlantic, and we were essential to the winning of the war, because we were right in the mouth of the St. Lawrence River, and the red and a vitally important position, and we had a major strategic importance during the war. So now I don't know how I got off and all that, but there you are. I want to encourage people to read, particularly about our history. And I mean, the Europeans have only been here in Newfoundland since the Basque were the first, as you know, over in Labrador, the whale fishery. And we didn't know about them till perhaps 15 or 20 years ago, till this Canadian woman discovered letters over in the museum or the archives in Spain, which showed that Spanish Basque fishermen had lived in Labrador and died there and made wills there. And now we've got this, and we've got the beautiful Red Bay. It's another marvelous place to visit. The other place that's wonderful to visit is our main fishing port, when the salt fish business was so important, the Labrador Battle Harbour. Mm-hmm. And so we've got some wonderful facilities like that now, and even cruise ships go into Battle Harbour, and they go into Red Bay. And this is what we've got to encourage, and the future of Newfoundland and Labrador, rural areas, is on these sort of assets that we've got that have to do with our history, and so we need to understand it.
Well, I'd really like to thank you for coming in today and talking with us. And I've got a book here, The Life of the Cottage Hospital, The Bombay Experience by John Crellin. And I have one of our cottage hospital ornaments for you. You can put on Government House tree come Christmas time.
Yes, sir.
And thank you very much for being here for our festival. And we look forward to hearing your few words tonight. And I'm hoping you're not going to be too politically correct. Thank you.
Well, look, I've made my mind up that when I'm no longer Lieutenant Governor, it's about 3 years' time, I'm going to write another book and let it all hang out.
Thank you very much. That's the honor. He's honored John Crosby, the Lieutenant Governor of Newfoundland and Labrador.
Yeah, well, I'm delighted to have been here, and we certainly intend to come back again.
Thank you.
Thank you.